Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, for those of you that are Bulwark Plus members, I want to tell you about something special we are doing tonight, Thursday night, at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Central Time. We're going to be doing another Bulwark Plus exclusive live stream, and it's going to be the team with David Frum, and we are going to be talking about the whole world of Trump election trutherism and where we go. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting conversation. We are in the midst of some genuinely crazy stuff. So if you are a member of Bulwark Plus, or if you sign up between now and then, you'll be able to participate in this live stream. They've been extremely well received, and we're very much looking forward to that.
I'll be there, and I might have a drink.
Tim Miller, you're going to be doing it. Well, of course, it's easy for you because you're like on East Coast time. I mean, on West Coast time. So
yeah, so I'm the appropriate amount, you know, of a drink and a half in usually for these things. While the folks on the East Coast have to calibrate a little better.
Yeah, well, no, see, in some ways, they're just all they have to do is like finish up the live stream and go to bed because it's late.
Good point.
You have a whole day, so. There's so much going on right now, including the president's 46 minutes of self-pity, petulance, deceit, and pure bullshit, the most important presidential address ever. Did you watch it?
I did suffer through it. I fast-forwarded a couple points because it got boring, but it was I felt obligated to watch it, actually. Okay. Because we cannot let this just live in a world where he's speaking entirely to his, you know, to the crazies and speak entirely to the cult members and have a separate stream of facts. I mean, there's an obligation of folks to watch the president
I think
when he's spreading this.
I think you're right, but you're a better person than I am because I could not bring myself to watch it. There's something still after all this time, just profoundly depressing about realizing that the president of the United States right now is the vector of the most dishonest, toxic conspiracy theory bullshit in America today. I mean, we can make fun of Sidney Powell, which I'm going to do, and, you know, the drunk witnesses that show up with Rudy Giuliani, but this is the president of the United States who is pushing stuff that if somebody would have come into Vladimir Putin's office and said, hey, Vlad, we could really F up America's democratic system if we spread this story and this story and this story, Putin would have said, no, that's crazy stuff. Get out of here. And he doesn't have to do it because it's Trump. Okay, so before we get into that, though, you need to take a moment to realize where we are at. 2,400 Americans died at Pearl Harbor. About 2,977 Americans died on 9/11. Yesterday, 2,885 Americans died of the coronavirus. And the president of the United States is still out there in this self-pitying, whining conspiracy theory. He's not doing anything. He's not addressing this. Yesterday, we hit this milestone of 200,000 new cases. 100,000 Americans are hospitalized. The CDC is saying more than 19,000 Americans could die the week of Christmas alone. And by the end of the year, somewhere between 300,000 and 329,000 Americans will have died from the coronavirus. And half the country, Tim, is like going, yeah, well, I'm bored. I just want to get on with it. And Washington's having one Christmas party after another.
I'm over it. Yeah, Charlie, yeah. It's really dispiriting. And I guess I just start by saying, I get it. You know, I don't understand the people that are spreading the conspiracy theories, but I understand the fatigue. You know, it's been a long time. You know, I've got in-laws I haven't seen in 9 months or whatever who are living too far, you know, on the other side of the country to make it work. And I understand that people get tired of this kind of thing. You know, eventually it wears on you. You try to it's just human, right? But the fact that, but what I don't get is that there just is a complete vacuum of anybody taking a leadership role and trying to rally the country to say, okay, we can survive this thing about four more months. Now that's actually not fair. You have Joe Biden that's trying to do that, but it's hard from outside, you know, in this sort of lame duck period for him to do it. And of the people who are actually leaders, and again, 98.99999% of the blame here is on Donald Trump. But, you know, we've got here in California, like Gavin Newsom and the mayor of San Francisco going to the most expensive, fanciest restaurant for little parties themselves. And, you know, you've got Mike Pompeo, who weirdly thinks he might be president in 2024, throwing like 9 Christmas parties in the state. Who are going to these like buffet, disgusting Christmas parties in the State Department, by the way? So, you know, across the board, there is just a complete lack of saying, let's call the country to a bit of shared sacrifice here during this Christmas season, right? Like, let's try to mitigate this for 3 more months. Because, you know, in the good news, I saw one estimate yesterday that said we might have 50 million of the vaccines out by February. I mean, you know, I mean, and that goes a long way to
this is good.
Yeah, it's good. That goes a long way to, you know, getting as close to actual herd immunity, right?
But we have to get from here to there, you know,
exactly. And that's not that long.
Yeah. If we can do that. Now, of course, like there's just so much that's going on right now. And I said yesterday, I don't know what you've been on Nicole Wallace's show a bunch this week. It feels like you're on every day, but.
It's just because when I go on, it's hot fire, Charlie. I'm actually not on that much.
Happens is it goes viral, you know, and people go, did you get a haircut or is that a ponytail? It's a debate that breaks out. But I think, you know, the next 60 days are the most dangerous days of the Trump presidency because of the distraction, the violation of norms. I mean, there's no norm that he won't violate. There's no standard of decency he won't shred. And so, you know, while this crisis is spreading, you know, not only is he ignoring it, but he's going to be just throwing up so much chaff and so many outrages that, you know, we're going to wake up at the end of this and go, oh, my God, look at the wreckage that's left behind. And it is horrific. I don't know.
Yeah, just really quick on that, Charlie. Yeah. Like the other thing is we've lost, I think maybe because we're out of campaign season and that people saw this in a campaign frame, which they shouldn't have. But like. We've lost again the sense of perspective amount about these deaths. I think maybe the numbers are getting too big.
Right.
But you know, and there's not been a single person in the Trump administration or in media, all of these, you know, coronavirus truther like mini celebrities like Alex Berenson. Like none of these people have had a moment and just said, you know, okay, I missed on this one. Like we need to recalibrate our priors on this. Like if you don't remember when I was on this show in April or May, like the standard thought among people who were concerned about this, like Jonathan Last and others who were ringing the bell, was like, you know, there could be about 200,000 deaths, right? Which is going to end up being a little low or quite a bit low. Like the Trumpers, you know, the president, these people were saying that there'd be, you know, well, at first zero, but then once it took hold, 50,000, oh, it'd be really bad if it was 70,000, you know, and there are going to be 4 times as many deaths, 5 times as many deaths as like the high end estimates at the beginning of this thing. And nobody has had a moment where, you know, like we're about to talk about, I think with Gabriel Sterling in Georgia, there's been nobody that stepped back and said, wait a minute. Can we just stop the madness here? I mean, this is insane. Like if you would have told somebody in March that in November or in early December, there'd be a day where there was 2,800 deaths.
And people are still making a joke of it. No, this is an important point because you know, I've been going, and I know you've gone through this as well. We've looked back on a lot of things that we have said and done and went, boy, you know, I was just wrong about that. Or I really, really regret that. Or what was I thinking when I did this? Or you reread an episode in recent history and you go, you know, I was absolutely on the wrong side of that. But, you know, as I pile up all of these regrets, I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to think I was on radio or television giving out information that may have led to people dying. I mean, that's a whole different level. I mean, it's one thing to be wrong about politics. It's one thing to be offensive about politics. But there have been people who have put out information on radio, on television, on the internet, that has encouraged people to engage in behavior that has killed thousands of people. And that's not hyperbole. This whole disdain for social distancing, the attacks on the efforts to mitigate this, the tribalization of masks, this has led people to die. And I will tell you, I'm really in a period right now where I'm okay with self-flagellation that, you know, I did this and this is the damage that it caused. But at least I can look back and think, I don't think I killed anybody. So I'm just imagining what that must be like and why no one's going, hey, you know what? I was wrong. And the only thing that I can do to make up for that is to tell you the madness has to stop now.
Yeah, lastly on that point, I watched Kaylee yesterday too. I'm just a glutton for punishment, Charlie. I don't know what happened to me as a child. This is something to, you know, spend some time on in therapy. But I watched Kaylee yesterday as well. And, you know, she's defiantly talking about how, you know, the liberals are not going to stand in the way of our celebration of Christmas and the celebration of the Christmas season, and adamantly and defiantly, you know, speaking out at yesterday's press conference about how Christmas will not be slowed down or canceled by the left.
It's defiant. And it's just like,
it's deranged. It's like, I mean, okay, you know, even if I guess that there's a probably slightly irresponsible way to think about it, which is like, we still want to mark this. We're going to do everything the right way. We're going to, you know, cancel the Christmas celebrations, but we'll have some, you know, it's not that. It's like this, it's this death cult madness. Like, we're going to go on as normal, just like Jesus would have wanted. It's crazy.
Well, it is crazy. And, you know, I mean, I'm like, the fact that I'm not going to be seeing my new granddaughter at Christmas, this is a real problem. I mean, I really get, I mean, you know, I'm angry about it. I'm disappointed about it, but this wouldn't be a sign of that. It was no tread on me if I decided to get in an airplane or a car to go out there and put my family's life at risk. I mean, that mentality is so crazy. So, you know, let me tell you what I'm wrestling with. I don't know if you know, it was very early there, but in my newsletter today, I write about the Republican Party as the, you know, leopard. What is the exact the phrase?
The leopards eating faces party.
The leopards eating people's faces party. It's not like they're going to eat my face. But I also had some thoughts about just hopefulness, because I realized that, you know, sometimes I'm on these podcasts or on the live streams and I'm the voice of optimism, but I find myself really struggling against it. And what I said was, Bill Kristol's got a great essay about, you know, maybe we're going to have a resurgence of liberal democracy and, you know, centrism and decency and stuff. And I really want that to be true, but it's hard to be optimistic because, you know, what I wrote was, when I was young, I used to think of hope as this, you know, many colored bird, you know, elusive, but filled with joyful, you know, portent, right? Now, when I'm tempted to be hopeful, I think of it as like this guy in a hoodie trying to sell me the same cut rate, you know, crack that he conned me into buying last week. I bought it too many times. I worry I'm getting too cynical about all of this. But, you know, hope seems that, oh yeah, it's going to be this next guy who's not going to break your heart. He's not going to crush your soul. He's not going to sell you out. Yes, you know, you're going to put your heart and soul into this scenario only to be disappointed. So it's hard. But, you know, I had to cite the late Rabbi Sacks, this brilliant man, Jonathan Sacks, who just died way too young within the last month or two. And he had an interesting way of looking at this. He said, you know, optimism and hope are not the same thing. Optimism is the belief the world is changing for the better. Hope is the belief that together we can make the world better. So what he's saying is that hope requires courage, that optimism is a passive virtue. Hope is an active one. So I'm not an optimist, but I'm really struggling to get back to hope. Did that sound like it was on point or a total?
Yeah, it's funny, Charlie. I haven't. I just always get called out if I haven't read the newsletter. I'm trying to get a coffee before I can get on the show here this morning. But I was thinking about a similar thing in a more kind of jokey fashion for the article I'm writing for tomorrow, where there was this one of Obama's famous lines was. In the unlikely story of America, there has never been anything false about hope. I don't know how well that one aged. That had a nice ring to it at the time. But I don't know how that, I don't know how well that,
you know, bending in one way. Okay, so here's something to be slightly hopeful about is that the, you know, the leopard eating people's faces party is amazingly, you know, biting people. What's going on in Georgia is just extraordinary to me. I mean, you know, Lynn Wood telling Republicans there not to vote for Kelly Loeffler or David Perdue because they haven't earned your vote. You know, and then you have, you know, Sidney Powell, who may be one of America's worst lawyers, the four-dimensional chess of, you know, telling people, you know, own the liberals by not voting. This thing of staggering genius. She says, I would encourage all Georgians to make it known that you will not vote at all, and thus your vote is secure. She wants a system of signed paper ballots, no Dominion voting machines. So she's basically urging Republicans not to vote in the January 5th runoffs. And now it's occurring to conservatives and Republicans that, wait, so these face-eating leopards are actually turning on us now. Like, amazing that if you bring cranks and crackpots and grifters and hacks into your inner circle and raise their national profile, bad things could happen, right? I don't know. How did they think this was going to work out? I mean, you know, yeah, it was a big mistake to bring in, you know, the Lynn Powells and the Sidney Powells. But what did you think when you actually elected a president who's a crackpot, you know, who's rose to power with birtherism, who lied? How did you think this was going to turn out, people?
I wish that I could share your enjoyable schadenfreude on this in Georgia, but
you're not.
I just can't, because these guys haven't been punished, actually. I mean, the leopards haven't eaten their faces yet. You know, I mean, Trump's face has gotten eaten, and sadly, the, you know, people have been victims of, you know, the virus and et cetera, his faces have gotten eaten, but all these Republicans got reelected, you know, all the rest of them. And I don't, you know, we'll see, how, you know, this sort of debate over, you know, between the really insane Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell tribe and the just kind of insane Breitbart tribe, like, turns out. But, you know, I do wonder if it's really just increasing the attention on this runoff, honestly, among right media folks. And it actually just on balance on net helps with turnout. I mean, runoffs are a pure turnoff out game. So anyway, I'm sorry to pop your balloon, but I'm just a little skeptical.
You had a little green shoot of hope there, and you just snuffed it out, man.
Yeah, sorry. I'm just a little skeptical that David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler's face is going to get eaten by the leopard. But I mean, there is nothing false about hope, Charlie.
There is the hope. See, and here's the problem. If they win, as is likely, this will be read by the Republicans. The way they've read all of this is that this works. The crazy works. There's no price to be paid for all of this. And let's go right on to Trump 2024.
Are you ready for this? Can we talk about that? Can we talk about these quotes from 2024?
Yeah, 2024. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Josh Hawley. I'm sorry. I know you have a special place in your heart for Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. But isn't Josh Hawley just the most craptacularly creepy member of the Senate right now?
Yeah, he attacked me this week, Charlie. Yeah, my content activations have been great. I got my ponytail was attacked by a celebrity, and Josh Hawley sent this like nonsense tweet at me about how I was making fun of this sort of notion about all these Republicans from before the election, you know, saying that they were the last, no pun intended, bulwark against the rising tide of socialism and Marxism in our country if Joe Biden had won the election. And then, like, now that the election's over and Joe Biden is obviously not a socialist or appointing any socialists to his administration, that the new line of attack is that, you know, it's these woke corporate liberals. You know, it's just like, well, wait, why didn't you tell me it was just going to be woke corporate liberals when you know, before the election? That might have appetizing
to it, did it? You know, it's
and so I attacked Hawley over that.
Like 93 election, because otherwise these corporate liberals.
Right. No. So Hawley attacked me over this and said, I don't understand. You know, it was a condescending, I don't have it in front of me, but some condescending thing about how you don't understand that the woke corporate liberals are spreading warmed over Marxism. And it's just like, you're just such a phony. It's just all bullshit. Like, what are you even talking about? Like, what, like, Marx is all about this anti-materialism. Like there were no woke corporate Marxists. Like, that's just not a thing. Like, you're just spouting buzzwords, you know.
This is the thing with Hawley. It is like he's got this Mad Libs of buzzwords, and he just sort of scrambles them up. You know, Black Lives Matter, critical race theory, you know, corporate liberal. And he just sort of throws it out because he wants to, you know, look like one of the kids. Remember, you know, that gif, have you seen that, where the guy is, so kids, you know, this is,
yeah, hello fellow kids.
Yeah, hello fellow kids, it's Josh Hawley, you know, hello fellow populist elitist hating folk out there. Yeah. Let's talk about
corporate. I just took my gap year in London at the elite St. Bart's school, whatever the hell school he went to in London.
Well, he's one of the people quoted in this article as saying what a great idea it would be for the Republican Party to be on hold for 4 years while Donald Trump continues to spin out his truthism, and then give him another 4 years in power, because that would be so great. And Josh Hawley he's there for it.
Yeah, I pulled him up here, some of these quotes, because I just think it's worth just really bathing in this. Marco Rubio, I will tell you this, if he runs, I think he would clearly be the favorite. I think he would win.
So at least Marco Rubio talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah, Donald Trump there. So at least little Marco didn't endorse him in the same way that Hawley did. Hawley said, I would support him running in 2024, and I think he would be the nominee. Rick Scott, I think it'd be great if he ran. Senator Daines of Montana, if he runs in 24, I support him. Senator Graham, I would personally support him if he did. Senator Blackburn, people in Tennessee are very enthusiastic about a second Trump term. I mean, this is madness, Charlie.
Yeah, this, like, is right now where they're watching him try to steal an election, asking the Supreme Court to overturn an election while spreading these wild-ass conspiracy theories and encouraging speculation about martial law. And at this moment, all these Republicans are going, yeah, this is good. We want more.
Sign me up for 8 more years of this, honestly. Sign me up for 4 more years of him as the titular head of the party, and then another 4 years of him as the president of the United States. Like 8 more years of Donald Trump? Like, what? Like, are they not watching him? I know that we've been over this again and again, and I know these guys aren't models of courage, but the fact that there's not even a group of them, and I'm not talking about, you know, we've got the Kinzingers and the Romneys and the Rigglemans, and good on them, but I mean the folks who really have a legitimate chance to take over the party, you know, the sort of soft Trumpists, if you will, like, could they not say that here is our opportunity to make this guy look like a pathetic, whining, lying loser? Like before the election, everybody said to me, Trump will be a loser. Everybody will see Trump as a loser afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is the moment. Could you imagine if after Hillary Clinton lost, she had a sad press conference where she was holding up charts, you know, talking about phony massive dumps that Trump kept talking about? Like it would have been the saddest thing. All of the Own the Libs crowd would have just made fun of her relentlessly forever until the grave. And but yet Donald Trump is doing the most pathetic, embarrassing loser behavior that you could possibly imagine, and all these guys are going, heck yeah. I mean, this could be their chance to break free from this. Doing strategic silence, they're like, sign me up for 8 more years.
Okay, so let me give you my, since you crushed my hope before, let me give you a slightly more, well, slightly less dystopian, horrific, okay, horror movie version of all of this, that this is basically their way of practicing toddler psychology. Which is, look, they want to make him stop being crazy. They want to make him not do anything even worse by saying, come on, Donald, you can come out. It's going to be okay. We're going to take you to the zoo next week. You know, you'll be able to come back. Just come along with us quietly. Don't break anything. Just stop screaming. Come on, get up off the floor. We're going to go to Chuck E. Cheese's next Thursday. This is the best.
They've been trying this strategy since 2015. So, I mean, okay, I hear you. It could be that. It could be that. But again, but do you have to go that far? You know what I mean? Like, when I'm working on that strategy with my toddler, it's not like, hey, we're going to go to Disney World with Grandma next week, and then instead, you know, we show up at the library, right? I mean, you try to put the best spin you have on reality. I mean, yeah, they're telling him, I'm going to support you in 2024. I mean, Josh Hawley's on the record.
He says that now. But, you know, Josh Hawley says lots of things. So, I mean, it's a little bit like toddler psychology if your toddler is holding a hand grenade.
Like if your toddler's holding a hand grenade, I might promise Disneyland. You know?
Yeah, yeah. See what I'm saying? It would change your strategy if the toddler's holding the hand grenade and you see that he's just about to take the pin out. So
that's a good metaphor. You sold me, Charlie.
What the conversation with Bill Barr is. I mean, this moment we're in right now where everybody's turning on Bill Barr because he won't back the conspiracy theories, and they're speculating that he might fire Bill Barr. They're speculating he might fire Chris Wray. I, by the way, I would put even money that the FBI director Chris Wray is not going to make it till January 20th because, you know, the toddler in chief just won't allow. As soon as Biden made it clear that he would keep him on, would let him, if he survives to January 20th, that Christopher Wray would be able to stay as FBI director. I think that really did put a target on his back, and that Trump is not going to be able to help himself from firing. Well, speaking of weird things, you see the story in the Daily Beast, Mike Pence backs away from the Trump reelection fraud train wreck. And then there's this anonymous quote, the vice president does not want to go down with this ship and believes much of the legal work has been unhelpful. What's with that? He's the last one.
You bought the ticket, Mike. Take the ride. You're on the ship. You're on the ship. You know, like I don't, you're on the ship. You're going down with the ship. And I mean, it is insane, right? He's in there. I think that a lot of these senators, you know, get to live in this sort of world where they genuinely, I mean, it's a shtick that they don't read the tweets, but they genuinely try not to. You know what I mean? I think that a lot of these guys, like, they're reading the Wall Street Journal ed page as their information, and they're getting briefed as necessary by their staffers. And, like, besides that, they're, you know, they're watching Fox, which puts the nice sheen on this stuff. And I just think that they're not getting the full crazy. And I don't, Mike Pence is in there, and he's getting, you know, the uncut powder.
Well, yeah,
he might be seeing just how nuts this stuff is.
He's totally screwed, of course, if there's a 2024 campaign. So let's talk about some of the stuff that we had in the Bulwark this week. We had one of your RVAT, the Republican Voters Against Trump stars, named Mark Becker, who was the former chairman of the Republican Party of Brown County here in Wisconsin, which is a key county. I mean, this is Green Bay. It's always been a swing county. And he became a Republican voter against Trump. And then wrote a piece for the Bulwark where he talks about a phone call he had with our good friend Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, who basically tells Mark, yeah, I know Biden won, but I can't say so because that would be political suicide. And yeah, Trump's an asshole, but he's accomplished a lot of all of this. And this got a lot of attention. I see that Johnson's pushed back, I've been totally consistent in my public and private statements. And labeled the article a political hit piece. No, apparently he hasn't been that consistent.
He deserved to get hit. I said when Mark sent that to me afterwards, I said, yeah, it was a political hit piece. You deserve to get hit. You were getting hit for your political hypocrisy and shamelessness and lies. I think good on Mark. I mean, for me, my big takeaway from this is, how many conversations like this have been had the last 3 weeks? Thousands?
Yeah.
And honestly, thousands with Republican elected officials who are publicly doing the fraud two-step and privately saying, okay, we just got to survive this 2 more months. You know, we kept the Senate. Good news. Like, let's just, you know, so we can do this. Like, that's what most of these guys are saying. I mean, you see, you know, some of them are kooks. Like, I think Rand Paul has gone all the way in on the fraud trutherism and the massive dumps being illegal and all this stuff. But most of these guys, I think, know the truth. But again, they're using the toddler psychology. and they don't want to say it. They know it is going to hurt them politically. They see, you know, their Twitter mentions, and it's all filled with like MAGA hat people saying, why aren't you fighting harder? And so if anything, they're thinking about that. Should they be doing what Ted Cruz did and putting out just unconscionably just pathetic press releases like he did, calling on the Pennsylvania election to be overturned,
7 million voters to be disenfranchised. Yeah.
So anyway, that's my thing. Is that good on Mark? And the reason why I think it resonated is because everybody knows that this is the case, and you know, people are desperate and thirsting for just being told the truth, right? And like, stop with this BS cosplay and just, you know, own it. Like, own Linwood, own all the craziness, own the drunk lady in Michigan, pretend like you really think that tow trucks worth of, you know, hundreds of thousands of ballots came in the dead of night, you know, or
North Korean ships came in with them, didn't they? Isn't Roger Stone saying that North Korean ships brought in ballots? Speaking of the drunk woman in Michigan, before we get to all of this, so I got a text last night from a prominent Wisconsin Republican who said basically that Trump has broken people's brains. Just talking about the kinds of communications he's getting with people and how impossible it is to reason with people.
They used to say that about us, by the way, Charlie.
Yeah, they're just, you know, throwing out all of this, the irregularities and, you know, and you know, suspicion, everything.
Remember TDS? Remember TDS? We were the ones that were turned into deranged over Trump.
Yeah, we were the ones. Mm-hmm. Well, see, that's one of the things I kind of like about what's happening now is that even the Trumpists are looking and going, those people are really crazy. Wait. This is what we thought about you back then. Yeah. Speaking of the drunk woman in Michigan, for people, I don't know whether people have spent much time watching these incredibly bizarre, often hilarious hearings that Rudy Giuliani is putting on, where he continues to come up with no actual real evidence. But they do seem like Saturday Night Live skits. And this one woman who's gone viral named Melissa Carone, who I think that her main qualification was that she was trained like as one day as a contractor and then went into in Michigan to be a, you know, ballot watcher or whatever she was. But I don't know whatever she was doing. But do we have the audio of this, Jim? Melissa Carone, who is sitting next to Rudy Giuliani talking to Michigan legislators. And I'm sorry, the universal consensus is that she's like, you know, smashed out of her mind. And here's the way it went.
The poll book is completely off. Completely off.
Off that by 30,000?
I'd say that poll book is off by over 100,000. That poll book, why don't you look at the registered voters on there? How many registered voters are on there? Do you even know the answer to that?
No, I guess I'm trying to get to the bottom of this here.
Zero. There's zero.
So my question then is
guess how many, wait, what about the turnout rate? 120%?
Let's let Representative Johnson ask his question, please.
So the poll book number, there's two things that could happen here. Either the poll book number, if ballots were counted multiple times, there's two options. Option number one is that the poll book numbers are not going to match.
They don't.
The actual. Not by thousands and thousands of votes. That's not what we see right now.
Take a look again.
Option number two is that they essentially were filling in names of people who didn't vote.
People too?
So is that,
Representative Johnson ask his question, and then when he's done.
I thought that
done,
was his answer. Okay.
Well, I guess my question here is why we're not seeing the poll book off by 30,000 votes. That's not the case.
What did you guys do? Take it and do something crazy to it?
I'm just saying the numbers are not off by 30,000 votes. So
I know what
are
I
you
saw.
Saying that they're filling in?
I know what votes? I saw. And I signed something saying that if I'm wrong, I can go to prison. Okay. Did you?
Okay, we're...
I'm sorry. You know, somebody was saying we need to get Kate McKinnon to play her. No, you can't do it any better than that.
Get her,
and yet here
get
we are
her.
In America in
can
December.
We get her on the pod, Jim. I think, can we track her down? I feel like we should get her.
Get her late in the day. But here we are, you know, in December 2020, and the American political dialogue includes this because we have this crazy ass conspiracy theorist president. Okay.
This is just really quick, Charlie, just really quick. Yeah. Just on this. Like, this is the, I mean, it's funny, and I just want to enjoy the humor, but the reason, the only reason why this is happening is because everybody is playing this massive nationwide game of pretend that there might possibly be some fraud. And this guy, this Republican guy who I have no sympathy for, who's trying to ask her questions, is trying to lead her to water and trying to like come up with, how can I make the most plausible, you know, open the door to the most plausible possibility that there might be some fraud here, and, you know, trying to be rational about it. And it's like, sorry, buddy, you bought the ticket, take the ride. You're with this lady. You know, it's just like hundreds of thousands of dead people. You know, you just gotta, you gotta either roll with it or come clean, right? Like this, the whole, the machinations of, you know, these people that are trying to put the intellectual sheen on this is really, it's, I take a little bit of pleasure in watching that. Some masochistic pleasure.
Well, you had a tweet earlier this week. You said, you know, it's rare in life when you are proved so definitively right. I think it was after the after the president himself tweeted out that, you know, an attack on the governor of Georgia, saying we just cancel the election because we don't need it because we will win. It's like, okay, the president of the United States is talking about canceling elections. You know, if you and I would have even speculated about this a year ago, people would have thought, well, now that's real derangement syndrome.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we would have had the smart people write columns about, okay, you know, we don't need this sort of hysterical overstatement. Nothing bad is happening here.
And the president would never call for canceling an election. They're saying, don't worry about it. Are the institutions held? It's just like, could you imagine what these people would have said had Barack Obama been doing this? It's just like, this is so far outside what was imaginable as acceptable behavior from a president. Anyway, it's infuriating.
Okay, this is now a good segue from the fun stuff to Gabriel Sterling yesterday. Gabriel Sterling being the one of the elections officials in the Secretary of State's office in Georgia, who by now everybody I think knows who he is or what he said. He came out and gave this really impassioned speech to, you know, about the this has got to stop. People are going to die. These death threats have gotten out of hand. Calls out the president, calls out the senators in Georgia for not condemning all of this, and basically says, look, this is dangerous. You know, you're attacking our democracy, but you're attacking the people who make the elections work. This could lead to terrible things. The president's response to that, of course, was to double down on the crazy, to engage in exactly the kind of rhetoric that Gabriel Sterling was saying was putting lives in danger. So let's talk about this, because I know that you guys on the Next Level podcast had a debate about all of this. Gabriel Sterling is a Republican. He is a conservative Republican. He sounds like he voted for Donald Trump. He says that he intends to vote for Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. So is it safe to say there are some people who think, screw that guy? No.
Yeah, that's the JVL take, which is just like, okay, yeah, great, pal. Like, now that this has come to your backyard, you're worried about this. The rest of us have been dealing with this for 5 years. Where you been? Yeah. And you're still going to vote for Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, who are spreading all the same things you decry. So, I mean, that was basically his take. And by the way, I'm sympathetic to that.
What was your take on that?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that take. I also don't, you know, think that you know, we should put Gabriel Sterling on Mount Rushmore or anything like that. But at the same time, it's like, somebody's got to do it. Yeah. There's just this craving for people to speak out and say clearly enough. And it's just, you know, since Jay Nordlinger had a good that tweet about this, which is like, have any of the Trumpers since the election come out and said, you know what, the guys, the never Trumpers really had it right on this. Like, this is just too far. Like, you know, some of them have said this is bad what he's doing, but have any of them taken the next logical step and said enough? And so, you know, it falls to a staffer for a mid-level, you know, elected official in Georgia to just come out and say what, you know, freaking Ben Sasse should be saying, what Liz, you know, what Kevin McCarthy should be, what Mitch McConnell should be saying, right? Which is like, enough of this, like, enough. Okay, so good for him, I guess.
I think so too. But I understand the argument, especially, you know, for those of us who've been yelling about this for the last 5 years, that you have a lot of these folks who did not seem to object when Trump was, you know, inciting violence against protesters, yep. was making up stories, was leading the chants of lock her up, or, you know, talking about beating people up, or, you know, send her back, or all of those things. They didn't have anything to say about that. But when it was them, that's when they became upset. On the other hand, okay, you know, what it comes down to is, if we're actually going to save this democracy, if the institutions are going to hold, it is going to require people like Gabriel Sterling and Raffensperger and Governor Ducey and Governor Kemp, and however much you dislike their politics in the past, if they don't do the right thing, then horrible things are going to happen. So if we're going to turn this around, it is going to mean that people who have been wrong are willing to stand up, wrong on their politics, are willing to stand up and say, okay, you know, yeah, we voted for these people, but we're not going to cross this line. So, yeah,
and well, I just a little thought experiment on this, Charlie. While I give them credit,
about talk about a shoot of hope, though, that a Gabe Sterling would come out and say, okay, enough of this, right?
Yeah, and this is my thought experiment on this, Charlie. It's just like, if this election had been closer, you know, we've all been saying this, if this election had been closer, this would have been a real danger that Trump would have taken it over. And if you look at the behavior of Raffensperger and Ducey, I don't know. I mean, I feel pretty confident that they were going to hold the line on what was true, no matter what happened. And then if you compare it to those jokers from the Michigan state legislature,
yeah,
you know, do you have any confidence, like, had this, I mean, Michigan ended up not being close. Like, you know, Trump lost by 150,000 votes. Had Michigan been a 5,000 vote margin, do you have any confidence that they wouldn't have either, you know, found some phony fraud claims, or the state legislature wouldn't have over, you know, sent in a different slate of electors? I mean, I think that this was needed, like that people stood up and just said, I'm going to follow the law here, and, you know, we're going to do the right thing here. And sadly, you know, the president and the United States Senate and Congress have put these guys in this position. And so, you know, good on the people that have done it.
Yeah, I mean, it is worth remembering how terrifying the alternative would be. So here in Wisconsin, there are these various lawsuits that are asking the Wisconsin State Supreme Court to throw out the election, throw out hundreds of thousands of votes, and essentially let the legislature send Trump electors. This is not going to happen because, and I am somewhat more optimistic about that, because even the conservative justices aren't going to go that far. Even the Republicans who run the legislature, who have their own level of arrogance, are not willing to go that far. If you flip it around and imagine if this had been closer, or this had been decisive, and imagine what a world would be like where the legislators didn't have those qualms, where the secretaries of state were willing to defy the law, where judges were willing to say, okay, we found some bizarre technicality that we've never enforced before, and we're going to use that to disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters. Then you're in a real nightmare scenario. So there's got to be some, I think, gratitude for the people who are doing the right thing. Doesn't mean you throw them a parade. What was Jim Swift's line? Don't make them the Grand Marshal, but at least give them a tasteful float,
yeah,
in the parade.
Yeah.
You know, okay, now speaking of other things that are actually happening in the world here, I have no idea whether they're going to come up with a new stimulus package, whether they're going to compromise. But I think it's going to be an interesting test case about Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, who, of course, famously just decided that he was going to make Barack Obama a one-term president, failed at that, but managed to slow everything down. I do think it's interesting that you have this centrist coalition which has come up with a compromise plan so the economy doesn't fall off the cliff. The only thing that seems to stand in its way is whether Mitch McConnell just basically wants to let it all burn down. So I don't know whether you have any feel for all of that. I am, as usual, not that optimistic about their ability to get this done, but I think it's going to be an interesting indicator of what the politics of 2021 is going to look like.
Yeah. I don't see a ton of evidence that they're going to get it done in lame duck. I mean, maybe McConnell decides, I guess, that it is that he wants to not let Biden get credit for anything, right? And so it's better to, you know, cut a deal now. I think that's the only logical argument I could see for McConnell pushing it through now, but he's got big parts of his caucus, and who knows what Mitch actually thinks in the depths of his black heart, but like he's got people in the caucus who are ready now to go back to austerity and pretending to care about debt and all that, and who aren't going to support this no matter what, and who think that, you know, the only thing to do to fix the economy is open everything up and let everybody die. I mean, there's a decent minority of the Senate caucus, or Senate Republican caucus, that's their view now. So to get it done, it does really have to be, you know, get bipartisan votes. And, you know, just isn't going to be something that Trump is, you know, besides an errant tweet now and then pushing for. So, I think that like the energy is against it unless Mitch really, really decides it's in his political interests to do it for the January 5th runoff and to not give Biden a win.
Yeah, this sounds right to me. What about the president's threats to veto the defense bill over number one, the renaming of the Confederate forts, and number two, his demand that Section 230, which has nothing to do with defense at all, be repealed? That's not going to happen. If Donald Trump actually did veto the defense authorization bill, my gut sense says that the Congress would say, screw it, we're going to override the veto.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. It's just hard to know, like, what he really, you know, what's going on. And he hasn't done, you know, he's had a lot of threats. There's been a lot of empty threats, you know, over the last 4 years. It's like, really, this is going to be his moment to do a veto over, like, the fact that his feelings are hurt about, like, Twitter trends being Fat Don or whatever it was, like, Diaper Don. I mean, I don't, maybe, you know, it's to your point about how this is the most dangerous, you know, period. It's like, I think that there are things that you can predict about what Donald Trump's going to do. He's going to be a man child and whine and complain and send tweets. And then there's that next layer out of, you know, more outlandish acting out. And, you know, he's going to threaten to do all that. But I think at this point, it's an open question how much of that, when it comes to firing Ray and the attorney general and actually vetoing military funding. I mean, if he really does think he's going to run in 2024, is he really going to veto? You know,
well, that's the interesting thing. That's the big question, because you know that he wants to self-pardon, or he wants to pardon Rudy Giuliani, or he wants to pardon his kids. But he's got to sit down at some point and go, okay, do I want to do that? You know, I can leave all kinds of bombs behind, but what does that mean for 2024? Oh, hey, I almost forgot. You had this big story, the biggest story in the Bulwark this week, about one of Trump's crack lawyers, Joe DeGeneva, going on Newsmax and suggesting that former cybersecurity chief Chris Krebs be taken out and shot. You were just like watching Newsmax because you're a masochist and you're watching that. And you were the only reporter in America to pick up the fact that DeGeneva was calling
I was. Had I not been hate watching Newsmax, nobody would have noticed that the president's lawyer threatened execution on a whistleblower, somebody who spoke out, and a public servant who just spoke out and said the truth about our elections. Yeah, I look, and this is how, and I've got two things in this, just about how crazy our times are and how our news environment is. And you know, one thing I think we can try to be at the Bulwark, and that I try to have as my North Star, is we are not constrained by the conventions of the media, right? Where you feel like you got to cover whatever the news is that day, and you got to show, well, you know, give the Trump side a fair shake and blah, blah, blah. Like we're not constrained by that. Like we can just look at this with, I think, a little bit more clear eyes about what's happening. And there are some stories that are just so crazy, but because they live in this kind of uncanny valley where they seem so crazy or ridiculous, like the mainstream media occasionally will just ignore them. And I think that's true about this DeGeneva thing. You know, people are not, for whatever reason, even though he's a lawyer for the president of the United States, the mainstream outlets do not have a beat for following this. They don't have a reporter sitting around following all the crazy things that Rudy is saying. And so stuff like this gets missed. I mean, in the before times, if a lawyer for the president of the United States threatened execution on a political foe, I mean, that would have been massive front page news for weeks, right? You know, there would have been hearings. But now that stuff just gets, oh, it's just Crazy Joe. And the same thing is happening about this Michael Flynn letter, which I just think we should talk about before we stop this. It's
yeah,
like,
please.
You know, Michael Flynn tweets and signs on to this letter that calls, along with Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood and other and another, I'm blanking on the other name, but another retired, I think, Lieutenant Colonel. JVL wrote about him yesterday. In the triad, if you want to go find that. And these guys are calling for a martial law and a temporary break from following constitutional order in order to silence the media, silence big tech companies who are spreading what they say is disinformation about the fact that they've seen the truth about this fraud. And execute a coup to keep Donald Trump in power.
And
this
bring
was
the
Donald
military,
Trump's national security
and bring,
advisor.
And bring the military in to conduct the election. So, I mean,
A re-election? Is that what they called for? A re-election.
A re-vote. So here's the thing about Mike Flynn, who, you know, retired general, used to be the national security advisor. He's either being rational or irrational. If he's being irrational, he's just a nut. If he's being rational, it's pure fascism, conscious fascism that he's talking about. And I understand that that's an extreme word, but what else do you call basically suspending the Constitution, declaring martial law, and bringing active duty military in to replace civilians and conducting an election? I mean, seriously.
It's Belarus.
So he's either, yes. So he's either of sound mind and body, in which case he's gone full fascist authoritarian, or he's lost his mind and it's pure insanity. I'm not
God
sure what's actually scarier.
Thank
you know?
God for that investigation. I mean, thank God that Michael Flynn was pushed out of the White House at the beginning. I mean, can you imagine like having the most influential national security advisor to the president being this crackpot who was on the take from Turkey and who's now calling for a military coup? I don't know. I just, again, this is like where you see this and like imagine what would be happening in another country. You know, if during the lame duck period in Germany, like the top military liaison to Angela Merkel was saying that they should call martial law and have a crackdown and stay in power, you'd be pretty nervous about what was going on in Germany. So, I mean, I think that we have a sense here, being here, of knowing that this is like really in the realm of crackpotville, and to execute a coup like this, you know, you need like other military leaders who like you, which Michael Flynn and Donald Trump have not done a very good job of cultivating. But, you know, I mean, that should be like, there is no precedent. There is no comparison. It's not like you can say like, oh, remember the time that, you know, Susan Rice, you know, called for instituting a military coup after she left. You know, there aren't examples of past national security advisors, George Shultz, you know, doing stuff like that.
Also, that we could be 5 minutes away from the president retweeting something like that, and that he could do that. Look, the rest of the world is watching this. I know that that's a cliche, but you know, the reality is that people in Denmark and Belgium and Belarus pay way more attention to American politics than we pay to their politics. They know how the Electoral College works. They know the ups and downs. I'm sure you get calls from reporters around the world, and it's always amazing the granular level of their knowledge. So they are, the whole world is watching America melt down in this particular way. So for, you know, the happy talk about how, well, our institutions proved to be resilient, we sent a massive message about how fragile everything was here and what hypocrites we are when we lecture the rest of the world about how to run elections when we have a president and a Republican Party that's behaved the way that it does. And by the way, the fact that overwhelmingly Republicans don't think this is a legitimate election is not a sign of success. I keep coming back to this analogy that, you know, we are the ship of state. We're still sailing along. And so, you know, the two cool for school kids are writing the piece about, hey, there was nothing to worry about, when in fact, a little while back, a, you know, massive torpedo below the waterline hit us, and we don't realize how much water we're taking in, and we're going to start listing in a few minutes that we don't really know how deep the damage of this is. So, I mean, the Mike Flynn stuff, it's again, it is so bizarre. that you have the president's lawyers calling for people to be killed. Okay, so it's a little fallout from your story about Joe DiGenova. You saw that today, that he's resigning under pressure from the elite Gridiron Club after an uproar over his comments suggesting a former government official should be executed. Now, you know what my main question was about that? The Joe DiGenova.
Why was he in the Gridiron Club in the first
place? Yes. Why was Joe DiGenova in the Gridiron Club? What kind of standards do those guys have?
Isn't that just kind of thing where you just know somebody and pay the bills? I don't know. I never, despite, you know, being told on the internet by the Trumpers that I was, you know, I'm just all in this for the Georgetown cocktail parties. I'm not really in that scene. So I don't have a lot of special insight to give you on how you get into the Gridiron Club.
Well, now this is cool because here's the local angle, because you know that I can always work Wisconsin in any conversation. Okay. So the Washington Post story this morning. Quotes the president of the club. We were dismayed by his comments. We felt that they were, on the top of everything else, just about antithetical to what the club is about, said club president Craig Gilbert, the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's a social club. We're all about fellowship and goodwill. So apparently they're not about actually taking your political enemies out and drawing and quartering them and having them shot at dawn.
Yeah, I mean, haven't all these clubs broken down though by the time? Like, how can you have goodwill with these people? You know what I mean? I think that is another, you know, the bad faith and the fact that, like, here's why we had to break the Joe DiGenova story, Charlie, is because things like this, maybe not exactly threatening people to be shot at dawn, but like crazy like this, you know, bad faith, you know, very disgusting attacks on opponents is just standard fare now in Trump's Washington. Yeah. It just is. And so without, you know, being all like, oh, we need comity and norms, like, you know, it has just broken institutions such as this. Like, who could you have? Like, who do you want to have in the Gridiron Club from this crowd? You know, do you want Kellyanne to come in there?
Is Kellyanne
all, just liars. And so it's like, how can you deal with this? Okay. And none of them are speaking out about Joe DiGenova. So yeah. I mean, that's just where we've landed, unfortunately.
So one last comment about this whole, you know, this rhetoric of violence and the danger.
Yeah.
I remain extremely concerned about it. Number one, because there's lots of crazy people with guns out there who feel that they have a Second Amendment right to show up at, say, the Michigan State Capitol and use their semi-automatic weapons to bully and intimidate people. So what could possibly go wrong? But the thing I'm really worried about is, you know, in social media, right-wing social media, I know this is going to come as a surprise to some of our listeners, there are people who right now still think that Donald Trump is going to be president on January 21st, that when it becomes clear that he has lost this election, they're going to be shocked by this. So we haven't really totally absorbed the people who are the deepest into the fever swamps have no idea the fact that it is completely over, that it's a joke, the stuff that we've been talking about here. And it will come they will be gobsmacked by it. And who knows how they will react when they realize that this coup has taken place, that the traitorous communist Chinese, North Koreans, Venezuelans, Marxist, socialist, corporate, liberals, whatever, have taken away their president. They're really going to be very unhappy.
Yeah, and it only takes a couple. You know, that's the thing. Right. It only takes a couple of them. And so the reason why I was watching Newsmax, I've got another thing for tomorrow that's just a broader, you know, look at what Newsmax is feeding these people. And it's hope after hope after hope. You know, it's like, well, if the state legislatures don't overturn it, if the Supreme Court doesn't overturn it, Congress can overturn it.
Yeah, right.
You know, so
they
it's going to
this can happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, so, you know, there is, you know, until the moment that Joe Biden walks in there, you know, there is going to be this sense of hope. And I, you know, like you said, I think that it's very reasonable to be concerned that one or a handful of these folks, you know, could feel like they need to take things into their own hands and be a mini Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yeah, and 5 minutes ago, responsible leaders understood their responsibility not to feed the beast, not to pour the kerosene, you know, on the dynamite here. But I don't know, that seems like a different century. So started off trying to be hopeful and everything, and here we are.
But I'm here to bring the bleak, Charlie.
You just remember the difference between hope and optimism. Optimism and hope are not the same thing. Hope requires courage, and we are nothing if not courageous at the Bulwark. Tim Miller, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Charlie. Talk soon.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.